Hello and welcome to The Debate. I'm Kaba Tafoi. The death of Palestinian prisoner Maysara Abu Hamdiya at an Israeli prison has drawn widespread condemnation in the occupied Palestinian territories. The Palestinian Authority has accused Israel of medical negligence. But what about the treatment of the other almost 5,000 Palestinians who are languishing in Israeli jails? In this debate, we'll discuss whether Israel is guilty of negligence along with their practice of detention without trial. Ask our guests why Israel, signatory to the Geneva Conventions, keeps violating its provisions with impunity.
The death of a Palestinian in an Israeli jail continues to send shockwaves across the Palestinian territories. 63-year-old Maysara Abu Hamdiya from the city of Hebron al-Khalil died of throat cancer on Tuesday morning. Abu Hamdiya was a senior Fatah official and was jailed for life in 2002. He began complaining of throat problems about 9 months ago and was diagnosed with cancer in February. His death sparked angry reactions from Palestinians who pointed the finger at Israel. Palestinians believe the Israeli policy of medical negligence brought about Abu Hamdiya's death.
We tried to get him released for treatment, but the Israeli government refused to let him out, which led to his death. This is continued policy of medical negligence of Israeli prison authorities against prisoners, as well as the delay in providing them with proper medical treatment.
Abu Hamdiya's death has united Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Palestinians in these territories have gone on a general strike with schools, shops and offices closed as a sign of mourning. Scores of people also marched on Israel's Ofa prison in Ramallah, where over 1,000 Palestinians are being held without charge. The marches and protests across the West Bank have triggered clashes between armed Israeli forces and Palestinians, who are only able to defend themselves by throwing stones. Meanwhile, 4,600 Palestinian prisoners are refusing food in protest over their fellow inmates' death. The prisoners are also protesting their detention without charge and the conditions of their arrest. As news of Abu Hamdiya's death broke, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip fired rockets at Israeli cities, with one hitting an area near the southern city of Sderot. The firing triggered Israeli airstrikes on the besieged enclave. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which rules the Strip, has blamed Israel for the escalation of violence and says Palestinians will continue to defend themselves. Observers believe tensions are on the rise across the region because windows of diplomacy have been shut for a while. Talks between the Palestinian Authority and Israel have been put on hold since 2010. The negotiations have collapsed because the Israelis are refusing to stop constructing new settlements and release Palestinians held without charge. At the same time, the United States continues to stand behind Israel while dragging Palestinians to the negotiating table. American military aid to Tel Aviv, which is set to extend annually through 2027, commits Washington to give up to $40 billion in additional grants to Israel. Against the backdrop of all this, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is set to visit the region. But given the history of deadlocks and impasses, analysts believe even Kerry's planned shot of diplomacy won't usher in a just solution, as many see the Americans themselves as part of this lingering injury.
Well, to discuss this further, let me introduce our guest. Former U.S. Senate candidate and host of the Ugly Truth Radio Network, Mark Dankoff, joins us from San Antonio. And we have former U.S. diplomat George Lambrakis, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. George Lambrakis, the death of Abu Hamdiya at an Israeli jail. He'd been suffering from an advanced stage of cancer of the throat. It is said medical negligence on Israel's part. Do you agree?
Well, I don't think you can ever defend deaths in prison. They happen around the world, and it's always a sad thing. When you're talking, of course, about cancer, there's absolutely nothing to show that getting out of prison would necessarily have prevented this death. Cancer, as you know, is a long-term illness. It sets in, and probably the person was going to die in or out of prison. I have no idea why the Israelis did not release him. I do know that the British released a Libyan who was in prison for terrorist charges, having helped to destroy an airplane with civilians on it. He was released because he had cancer, and he did not die immediately. He survived quite a long time. So it's very difficult to know. However, all of this, as you realize, is simply politics grabbing hold of something that has just happened to show the anger at the political situation, which has been going on for many years, of course, between Israel and the Palestinians. And so this is just a way in which people from time to time get very angry and grab hold of whatever is the issue of the moment to show their anger. And I can understand that they have anger. On the other hand, I've been following the problems of the Israel-Palestinian issue for 30 or 40 years now. And unfortunately, whenever you get close to what you think might be a solution, which usually the Americans are in the process of helping to solve, unfortunately, it falls apart for one reason or another. And you can't blame one side or the other, I think, more than one side more than the other. On the other hand, in this case, it looks like we're in for a little more trouble, despite the fact that President Obama, I thought, did a very good job in trying to show both to Israel that the Americans will always defend them, but also to the Palestinians that the United States really wants Israel to work, as well as the Palestinians, to work for a two-state solution, which the United States has been behind for many years.
Well,
we have the problem that on the Palestinian side, of course, Gaza is controlled by Hamas, and Hamas says they will not negotiate. They will only drive the Jews into the sea. They haven't changed this kind of argument for many, many years. It doesn't help the situation. It makes Israelis fearful of what would come if they did back off and allow freedom in the West Bank.
Well, let's discuss some of the reasons why this peace process has failed. And Mark Dankoff, this death of this Palestinian prisoner while in Israeli custody is said, well, Israeli authorities, they're fully responsible for his well-being. It's part of the Geneva Conventions, aren't they?
Well, it's kind of interesting looking at this whole situation because, after all, this is the same regime that gave us Operation Cast Lead. This is the same regime that gave us the illegal attack on the Mavi Marmara. This is the same regime that had a very interesting case recently involving an Israeli Australian citizen by the name of Ben Zygier, who clearly was working for the Israeli Mossad, who had a very, very convenient suicide recently while in Israeli custody. It seems to me that when you look at this whole situation, whether you're talking about this one Palestinian death in prison, which is a tragedy in and of itself, or you're looking at Israel's ongoing policies of international lawlessness, which includes their ongoing refusal to negotiate on Jerusalem and the continued expansion of these illegal settlements with the full funding and enabling of the United States, this is at the heart of the problem. And I think when you look at the geographic map of Palestine since 1948, it's clear that the Palestinians continue losing, that they continue losing more land, that they continue being the victims of more and more state-sponsored violence. And frankly, the notion that they are the intransigent party in these negotiations is completely preposterous.
George Lambrakis, we want to talk about law, the Geneva Conventions. Israel is a signatory to it, isn't it? We can talk about the Fourth Geneva Convention, the UN Standard, minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners, etc. Why is Israel not following and respecting international law and humanitarian law?
Well, I'm not sure that you can say that it's not respecting all of it. I guess there are many different theories. As you know, we have spoken about this kind of thing in the past. You can't just say that Geneva says that you have to release someone because he has cancer. You have to look and see why that person is in jail in the first place. You have to look at the whole business of incarcerating people who are seen to be dangerous, perhaps because they've already carried out dangerous acts, perhaps because they have been found to be plotting dangerous acts. We see this with the United States when it comes to Al-Qaeda and other militants. We see this in many other parts of the world. In places like Iran, people have been thrown into jail because they were in the wrong party, and often they never come out of jail. They're executed. So, you know, bringing in Geneva Accords to make an argument on one single case is not really very helpful. Sure, there are Geneva Accords. It would be good if everybody decided to respect them in exactly the same way. But, you know, you're talking about basically a war situation, but there isn't a war either. And so which parts of the Geneva Accords do you apply and in which situations? We've been arguing about this for years.
Yeah, but let's look at some examples here, George Lambrakis. This is a weekly report that comes out every week. And what we have this past week, Israeli forces conducted 37 incursions into occupied West Bank. 26 Palestinian civilians, including 6 children, were arrested. Palestinian child was arrested while attempting to cross the border into the Gaza Strip, not to mention shootings, restriction of movements, settlement buildings, and cutting off water, which was in the news a few days back, to 10 towns in the occupied West Bank. Now, these are happening on a weekly basis of some form or another. And you're saying that we can't apply the Geneva Conventions when this is happening on a weekly basis?
Well, I'm not going to try to defend the Israeli settlement process or many of the nasty things that happened between the settlers and, in some cases, the military, the Israeli military and the Palestinians there. We know what the situation is. As far as protecting the border goes, as far as keeping people from crossing the border illegally, there's nothing against that in Geneva or in any other accords. Yes, there are aspects of the Geneva Accords that say you should treat occupied population differently from the way Israel has been treating them in the settlements area, of course.
Well, Mark Dankoff, in same question.
And I do agree with your other speaker there for much of that.
Mark Dankoff, same question to you. Weekly, week in, week out, we're getting these reports. Again, detentions, also not to mention detentions without trial that happens, that Israel abides by its own rules on that. Freedom of movement, settlement buildings, etc., and all types of international laws. And the international community is also deeming these types of activities illegal. Yet we have George Lambrakis, who somewhat is defending these activities on the ground, if I'm understanding you correctly. Why is that Israel keeps committing and violating these terms of these international laws?
They're doing it with impunity because they continue to have the wholesale political and economic backing of the United States. Just look at this latest visit of Barack Obama, which of course was preceded by the visit of Republican U.S. Senator Rand Paul. Rand Paul, unlike his father Ron Paul, made a series of statements in Israel which made it very, very clear that if Rand Paul is the Republican candidate for president in 2016, that Rand Paul will go along with absolutely everything that Israel wants done in terms of its foreign policy arrangements. Rand Paul is signing off on all of these aggressive behaviors that the United States is undertaking against the present regime in Iran, just as one example. And Rand Paul would seem to be very, very amenable to Israel continuing with these illegal settlements and the continued pouring into that country of all of this American money. Then we have Barack Obama's visit to Israel, whereby he commits the United States to yet another $400 billion over time in helping to fuel Israel's military machine. This is at the same time that there's absolutely been no significant concession on the part of Israel, either in terms of Jerusalem or in terms of these illegal settlements or what they're doing in Gaza. The United States is chiefly to blame for this. And the United States, of course, has used its position in the Security Council to make sure that anything that is said about Israel in the General Assembly is subsequently vetoed by the United States in the Security Council. When you look at the number of resolutions that have passed the UN General Assembly in regard to Israel's repeated violations of international law, absolutely none of these have gotten past the United States in the Security Council. We have turned around, our government has turned around in this country and facilitated ongoing financing of Israel to the tune of what is actually believed to be about $10 billion per year, even aside from these latest military commitments that the president made when he was there visiting Mr. Netanyahu. So the U.S. is aiding and abetting and enabling all of this. The funds from the United States to Israel continue with no sign that the spigot will even be lessened. And as long as this goes on, Israel will continue to do whatever it feels that it would like to do, whether it's the settlements or the status of Jerusalem or what they're presently doing in Gaza or what they're doing to these Palestinian prisoners in these jails.
George Dombrakis, then, from what Mark Dankoff says, the U.S. support of Israel has moved forward, and yet, in terms of peace talks, you could finish the sentence there. I mean, has the U.S. failed in this regard?
Well, I'd like to correct you when you said that I was kind of defending these moves of the Israelis in the Palestinian areas. I certainly do not defend most of what we've been talking about in this program. At the same time, I know you'd like to have a bigger argument. I tend to agree with most of what was said by your other speaker. I should point out, of course, that the American government is essentially reacting to the major political views of Americans about Israel, and they are colored by the fact that the United States stands behind the existence of Israel and against arguments that Israel should be destroyed. And from that, it is easy to jump to not attacking Israel when the Israelis do some pretty extraordinary and bad things in the settlement areas. How many presidents have tried to stop the Israelis from continuing their settlement policy? Even Obama clashed with Netanyahu on this. The Israelis, after all, don't always follow what the Americans tell them, and the Americans are not in a position to impose their views entirely on Israel any more than other big countries are on small countries around the world. And the idea that the Americans run the world, particularly this idea that is big in the Middle East, that the CIA is doing everything that happens in the world, is completely wrong. But it's very difficult to get it out of people's minds, particularly when some governments in the area keep trying to drum it into people in order to make people turn against the United States. The United States has been behind a two-state solution. It is against the settlement policies of Israel, as it has made clear many times. We have come very close to getting an agreement on a two-state solution. It has not always been the Israelis that have spoiled it. It has been on a couple of occasions in the past, the Palestinian negotiators who turned down what appeared to be the best possible deal you could get at that time. And of course, as the years go by, the deals tend to be more and more difficult, partly because so many Israelis are settling in the Palestinian, the West Bank area, which in theory should go, most of it, to the new Palestine. But unfortunately, the efforts to get a solution, which, as I said, I have been following for many years, always seem to fall between a rock and a hard place. Either the Israelis mistrust the Palestinians or the Palestinians mistrust the Israelis, and in the end, they one or the other or both say no.
Well, Mark Dankoff, let's look at the U.S. Secretary of State. John Kerry is due to visit the region. When he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he said, quote, "We are serious about Israel freezing settlement activity in the occupied West Bank." Of course, he didn't say occupied. He just said the West Bank. Do you think he's serious about that as U.S. Secretary of State?
No, I don't think he's serious about it any more than Hillary Clinton was serious about it, any more than the previous Republican Secretary of State was serious about it. And again, this gets back to the disproportionate control of the Israeli lobby in the United States of our elections. Look at these 30-plus political action committees known to be connected directly or indirectly to Israel that are pouring incredible amounts of money into these American political races. Look at these super PACs and people like Sheldon Adelson with the amount of money that he put into the campaign of Mitt Romney and before that Newt Gingrich and the Republican Party. The fact of the matter is this, and nobody wants to talk about this, of course, in the U.S. because it's considered to be taboo, but whether you're talking about the amount of Jewish money in American politics, the disproportionate Jewish control of the American news media, the disproportionate Jewish control of the international central banking structures, the fact of the matter is all of this plays into the fact that Mr. Kerry represents a political party where it is believed that approximately two-thirds of the money that goes into the Democratic Party is coming from Jewish sources. The Republican Party, not as much, but certainly very, very significant. And the fact of the matter is that if Kerry was at all serious about this, if his Republican predecessor had any serious intentions in this regard, Israel would simply have been told that its conduct could not continue, the conduct that it has exhibited since 1948, and they would be told specifically that there would be a major cutback, if not an out-and-out shutoff of American money to their activities until they negotiated seriously on the status of Jerusalem, a serious two-state solution, and a serious termination of these illegal settlements that are being presently undertaken in the occupied territory. The fact of the matter is that Kerry can say anything that he wants to, as long as the United States, with both the Republican and the Democratic parties, continues to funnel the kind of money that it does to Israel. And when the President of the United States, whom Mr. Kerry is allegedly working for, just hands over to Israel another $400 billion in defense and military money over time, this tells virtually anyone looking at this what's going on. Follow the trail of the money. Read not their lips, but read their budgets.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, former U.S. Senate candidate and host of the Ugly Truth Radio Network, Mark Dankoff there from San Antonio. Also, former U.S. diplomat George Lambrakis spoke to us from London. And thank you for watching another edition of The Debate. Any questions or comments, do send it to newsroom@presstv.ir. From Mikova Tafoy and the entire team in the capital of Taiwan, it's goodbye.